It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new study on some ancient footprints on a Greek island is shaking up the timeline of human evolution. We'll get the details with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. First, state lawmakers held a public hearing Thursday in Ladysmith on a new mining bill that would get rid of the state's effective moratorium on sulfide mines. The legislation is creating a political fight between environmental groups and business interests. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's been covering the mining bill. He joins us from our Eau Claire studio. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Give us the basics on this legislation. How would it change existing law regarding sulfide mining?
Well, in its most basic form, Wisconsin for the last 20 years has had some people call it a moratorium, some people call it a permit requirement, but for the last 20 years, if you wanted to open a mine to look for gold, you know, non-ferrous metals, anything like gold, zinc, copper, cadmium, etc., you would have to provide examples, one or two examples of a mine that looked for minerals in a sulfide-bearing ore, or sulfide mining to be short, but you'd have to provide examples of another sulfide mine that went for 10 years, operated for 10 years without polluting the environment, and was closed for 10 years without polluting the environment. You had to give those examples before you could even apply to mine in Wisconsin. So what the bill that Senator Tom Tiffany, a Republican from Hazelhurst, is introduced, that would basically get rid of that prove it first provision and make some other technical changes.
And as you mentioned, there's a question over whether we call what we have a moratorium, but it, however you shake it, it's a pretty big hurdle if you want to open this kind of mine. So this would definitely change the landscape for people considering opening mines. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a big enough hurdle that we haven't had a sulfide mine in Wisconsin since 1998 or 1997. That's when the Flambeau mine officially closed. And there was an attempt up in Crandon in the northeast part of the state to start a sulfide mine there. But when this law, there was huge opposition to it from tribal and non-tribal grassroots folks. And when this bill passed the legislature that created what we now call the mining moratorium law, that basically hit the brakes on any new sulfide mines.
Well, let's look at the arguments. What do environmentalists generally say are the concerns about sulfide mining?
Well, that you're disturbing an ore body that, when exposed, this rock is high in sulfide, so when it is exposed to air and water, it literally breaks down and creates acid. It creates acid mine drainage, which, if you've ever seen a picture or a video of a river or a stream that had turned bright orange and looked dead, that's acid mine drainage. It basically is very harmful to any living things.
And then supporters of this bill, what are they saying about those worries, those concerns?
Well, they say that you know, that's the way mining was done. You know, those images that you see, they say those are from the 70s or the 60s, that we've come a long way with technology. We can do this sulfide mining safely. And bottom line, Tom Tiffany says that this bill, if passed, would open up the doors to a $1 billion industry, because he and some of the geologist folks that testified say that there is a belt of this ore. They call it a green rock, or a belt that is super high in concentrations of things like gold, copper, and other metals that are useful. I mean, that we all use every day in one form or another. So economics, he said that this part of the state is really hurting, and Senator Tiffany and others believe that if they're allowed to open mines in these parts, they can be done safely and revitalize that part of the state.
We're talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, about a proposal to change Wisconsin's mining laws to make it easier, in effect, to open different kinds of metal mines around the state, non-iron metal mines in particular. Rich, take us to this hearing now on Thursday. What was the atmosphere like there?
Well, it wasn't as busy. I thought it would be. This was at the Ladysmith High School, and it was held in their auditorium, so there's a lot of seats there. And I was, frankly, expecting it to be jam-packed, because back in the 90s, from what I've been reading, this was such a lightning rod of an issue. But there was maybe 100 people, probably less, total in the in that room. Most of the people that I heard speak were speaking against the mine. The beginning, or the bill, the beginning was set up. You could tell that the first speakers were probably introduced or invited, I should say, by some of the folks on the panel, specifically Tom Tiffany. But so you heard the pro mining argument in the beginning, and then a lot of people speaking against it afterwards. And so one of the pro mining sources was a gentleman who is a an economic geologist, and I'm losing his name right now. Oh, Roger.
There is a
Oops, shoot. I wasn't supposed to play that. You're supposed to play. Roger David Morton. He's an economic geologist. Here's what he had to say about the possibilities of opening up mining in this part of the state.
There is a tremendous potential for the future for developing these greenstone belts in Wisconsin into something which will really contribute what you need, namely employment and cash flow.
And then did Morton and others, the geologists there, say not only could we do this effectively economically, but in a safe way as well?
Yes, yes. They all basically made the argument that they were pointing a lot to the Flambeau mine itself, which operated for about 5 years and didn't have any massive environmental problems, although it was sued for being in violation. The groups that sued it said that it violated the Clean Water Act, and that kind of went back and forth in court. So they say that this can be done, that nobody wants to destroy the environment. You know, they're making the case that even these mining companies have the best interests of the environment and the locals at heart.
And you mentioned that there were critics speaking, mostly critics, it sounds like, speaking at this event. What kind of things did you hear from them?
Well, basically that one of the overarching arguments was that we don't need to get rid of this mining moratorium law. They said that there's, in effect, there's nothing stopping companies from mining so long as they are able to prove that it can be done, you know, with evidence, safely. And their argument is that's why if they point to the Flambeau mine, why can't they use the Flambeau mine as an example? Because there was this discussion about whether or not there's acid mine drainage coming from it. But Al Geddix, he's the executive secretary of the Wisconsin Resources Protection Council, which had played a big role in getting this moratorium law in effect back in the 90s, and also trying to stop the Crandon mine. But he also spoke against the bill.
After 20 years of experience since the passage of the mining moratorium law, the mining industry still cannot demonstrate that sulfide mining can be done without polluting the environment, so they want to abolish the law. This legislation does exactly what they want.
So, Rich, what is next for this bill?
This bill will get a vote with the committee, the Sporting Heritage and Mining Committee. And then it will go to the full assembly and full Senate. But right now, both houses are very busy with the budget. So I can't imagine there's going to be a ton of activity on this anytime soon until Foxconn is dealt with and until the state budget is finished.
As we wrap up, Rich, was anybody making the case that there are mining companies ready and willing and with spots in mind to open up a mine once this thing passes?
Well, Senator Tiffany alluded to hearing from companies who, and there were some lobbyists there from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and others. But yes, there was some hint that there are companies ready to go if this law gets repealed, and they'll be ready to go.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR News reporter based in Eau Claire. He joined us for the latest on a state bill that would eliminate Wisconsin's effective moratorium on sulfide mines for a lot of different kinds of metallic ore. Now, a new study shows ancient human relatives were walking across a Greek island 5.7 million years ago. Hominids, who are part of our family tree, weren't thought to be at the site of these footprints until millions of years later. Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us about once a month to talk about cool science news. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, how big a deal is this study before we get into the details?
Well, I have to say this could be a very big deal. And the bit of hedging there, comes from the fact that this is not as certain as if, say, we found the actual fossil, the actual skeleton of a hominid. But, you know, this is a trace fossil. That's what they call fossilized trackways. And it's pretty enticing.
Okay, tell us about this footprint and where it is and what we know about when it is.
Okay, sure. And just a tiny bit of background. When you look at the evolution of hominins, and hominins are basically any primate that is more closely related to us than to apes and chimps. So hominins are all the primates that are kind of on our side of the human-chimp split. And the oldest known hominin in the fossil record right now, it's from Chad in Africa. It's called Sahelanthropus, and it's about 5.8 million years old, give or take. So this 5.7 million-year-old potential fossil trackway is almost as old as the oldest actual hominin fossil we have. And the fact that it's in Greece is kind of mind-blowing, because we don't expect to find any hominins there for millions of years later, about 4 million years later. So all of a sudden, you've got this really early hominin that apparently was walking around in Greece, and what's even more incredible is the impression left by its foot, if that's what it is. Again, I have to hedge that, but the impression suggests a foot that was already fully developed for walking on two legs or being bipedal. So there are all kinds of really fascinating things. The age, the location, and just the advanced anatomy of what appears to be footprints.
Now, it's good to be clear here. This is not grandpa we're talking about. This is probably not a direct line ancestor of modern humans, right?
That's correct. That's correct. In fact, I spoke with one of the authors of the paper, and he said he wanted to be very clear that all evidence we have of every kind is that modern humans, you, me, every other modern human on the planet, we all evolved. Our roots are in Africa. So he's not saying that, hey, we evolved in Europe, but it appears that there was at least one very early hominin, kind of a different branch of the family bush rather than the family tree, but one very early hominin was strolling around Europe way, way back.
And I gather there was some pushback in the scientific community. Why was that?
Oh, my goodness, yes. There was a lot. There was a lot of pushback, and it was from a lot of different perspectives, quite frankly. You know, human evolution is kind of a very special thing within paleontology. The field of paleoanthropology, a lot of researchers have invested a lot into their work, of course, but there's also this extra layer. In fact, the author I was speaking with called it a mythology about human evolution. You know, this is not just the story of a dinosaur or an extinct fish. This is our story. So people attach a lot of extra symbolism, and every new find really gets challenged. So that's one part of the puzzle. And then some other researchers are saying their data is looking pretty good. Their dating methods were very sound. We have no comments with that, but, you know, they didn't look at all the possible explanations for these footprints. They didn't look at all the possible animals already known to the fossil record that may have made these tracks. So a few researchers I've spoken with feel that maybe the team jumped to conclusions a little bit. And I put that question to the co-author I spoke with, and he said, you know, everybody take a breath. We have even more detailed analysis coming out in a couple months. So I'll reserve judgment, but it's huge if it turns out to be hominin footprints.
It seems like there's just this rash over the last couple of years, Gemma, of new data points in human evolution, hominin evolution. Why are we finding so much stuff now?
Well, you know, I think researchers are always finding new stuff, and they're always finding stuff that really challenges things we thought. And you know, that's how science advances. It's when you find something that is initially very controversial, and then other researchers come in and find evidence that supports what you found. But, you know, in this case, there are so many different ways now to test and to analyze and to look at whether it's a fossil or some ancient DNA or even a fossil trackway, that we can look at it in so many different ways, whether it's digital scanning, CT scanning, you know, sequencing, all these different ways that really helps researchers get beyond what you can just see with the naked eye or under a microscope. And I think that is creating a lot of new discoveries in a lot of new areas that, quite frankly, I think it makes it even more fascinating.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the coolest news from the world of science. Moving on, Gemma, new research on how people in the ancient Incan Empire communicated with each other. Now, they had this, it's called quipu, am I saying that right?
I think so, yeah.
These are these famous string things with knots. And I've seen things, I was at the Smithsonian, they had this amazing thing on the ancient Incan roads all through what's now Peru. And they had examples of these things. And what I thought, and I guess what people thought, was these were counting. You counted how many livestock you had with these. But they're way more than that, it looks like.
Oh, my goodness. They are so complex. And again, this is something that researchers are just getting into to really determine their complexity and what may be hidden in the lost language of the quipu. And just for readers who haven't seen them, who might have a little trouble visualizing, if you just picture this cord of a textile, you know, most of them are made of cotton, but some of them are made of animal hair and other things. You have this cord, and then from it are hanging all these other cords, and they're either different colors or different fibers, or they have all these different knots that are spaced differently, or maybe the knot is tied clockwise or counterclockwise. So there are all these kind of binary differences within the cords and pendants, and it turns out, yes, we've known for more than a century that that was kind of like a counting method to say, okay, I have 20 sheep, or I just sold 5 sheep, whatever. But it turns out that a couple of researchers think the way the knots are tied, the ply, which is the way the fiber is actually twisted into a thread, all of that is a binary code that could be male or female, high status or low status, sheep or goat. So it becomes this whole language hidden in the cords. And this one researcher thinks that she has uncovered potentially a phonetic code hidden in the quipu that actually, you know, could be read kind of like the kanji in Japanese. So it's really fascinating research, but when we think that the Inca Empire from the 15th and 16th centuries spread over 3,000 miles, had as many as 18 million people, and didn't have a written language, that's always been kind of a puzzle. How do they keep track of everything? How do they communicate? It turns out that it may have all been through the quipu.
And what kind of messages do these researchers think might have been hidden in these?
Well, you know, just like think of your email. You've got emails that are receipts for maybe something you ordered in an online company. You've also got emails that are messages to your friend, hey, when we're getting together this weekend. So pretty much anything that you could record in a written language could be recorded in quipu if the latest research is right.
Yeah, I was going to say, this complex set of messages formed by very simple series of binary combinations. That sounds like something. This is kind of like a string computer, basically.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Well, I want to move on to one more science topic, the definition of animal domestication, like how humans domesticated dogs or how cats domesticated humans. We're changing, I guess, our definition of what animal domestication means. What's going on?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. About a year ago, a study came out offering a new and broader definition of animal domestication and domesticated animals, saying basically over generations, it is a mutually beneficial relationship between two organisms, one organism influencing reproduction and care of another. And it was the first time that a researcher had proposed a definition of domestication that didn't have the word humans in it. And that's because we're finding more and more species, especially in the ant world, that actually domesticate plants and animals. There are ants that farm fungus and herd aphids, and there are all these relationships way beyond humans that turn out to qualify as domestication.
Huh. So, yeah, I would, if I thought animal domestication, I would instantly leap toward humans being involved in one end of that equation. So ants are doing it, too, and other species.
Yeah, yeah.
How does it work, though, when ants are domesticating, say, aphids?
Well, basically, they get a couple aphids, and instead of just nibbling on them or different ants do different things with the aphids, but instead of, say, using them as a food source immediately, they keep them around, they keep them in conditions that are nice for making more aphids, and then, you know, when they need a meal, they go to it. They snack on their investment, shall we say.
And then I gather we're learning more about how we humans have domesticated other species. Things like, why do dogs have floppy ears and bigger eyes than wolves do?
Exactly. And this is, you know, it's not just dogs. It's throughout vertebrates that have been domesticated, whether they be, you know, chickens or goats or pigs or dogs or cats. They do have this suite of features that's long been called the domestication syndrome. And it's only been recently, in the last couple of years, that researchers have figured out that this so-called domestication syndrome actually is the result of a deficit in neural crest cells. And neural crest cells are these cells that form kind of along what becomes the spine in a vertebrate embryo. And as the embryo develops, these neural crest cells kind of march out throughout the body to affect all different kinds of functions, everything from if your ears are straight up or floppy to what color you are. And it turns out with domesticated animals, when they're still embryos, the neural crest cells move more slowly. That's the deficit, the neural crest cell deficit. So some of these cells never reach their their intended target. So they never impact, say, the color of an animal or whether its ears are floppy or erect. And that is actually why we end up with this domestication syndrome. It's super complex. I've massively oversimplified it here. But trust me, it's a very fascinating look at how this thing that Charles Darwin observed more than a century ago, really how the science behind this actually works.
We'll leave it there for now. Gemma, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. Based in Waukesha, she joins us about once a month to share cool science news. Back to school season is back to sports season for a lot of kids around Wisconsin. Football and soccer, tennis and cross country, team sports are kicking off for schools and clubs. Our next guest says youth athletics have the potential to be very positive experiences for kids, but we don't always reach that potential. High costs and high pressure take the fun out of the game for some kids, while a lack of access to fields, coaches, and teams put sports out of reach for many others. Tom Ferry is a longtime sports journalist. He's executive director of the Aspen Institute Sports and Society Program, and he's the author of Game On, the All-American Race to Make Champions of Our Children. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Well, Tom, we talk sometimes about the negatives associated with youth sports, the risk of concussion, the costs and such. But before we get into any of that, let's spell out some of the positives. What do you see as the benefits of youth involvement in team sports?
Well, look, I mean, I wouldn't have left my career with ESPN and devoted myself to this topic if it weren't absolutely full of positives and something that can be super redeeming for kids and, you know, building, making them healthier and healthier communities. So we got to remember that youth sports done right can be hugely valuable, you know, to towns, to kids, to families, or otherwise. I mean, it could build, you know, habits of health and fitness for life. It can build social connections. It can build physical literacy. It can build resilience, all sorts of character traits. I mean, it doesn't necessarily do that. I mean, it's a neutral institution, and if done poorly, it can break kids down and break communities down. But when done right, it's a terrific institution.
Now, you work on periodic reports about the state of youth sports in America, and I know one of your biggest areas of concern is access. A lot of kids, for one reason or another, because of where they live or because of limited time or funds on the part of parents, a lot of kids don't have access to quality programs. What can we do to bring that up?
Well, I mean, first we have to make a commitment to all kids and not just our own. Right. So, I mean, part of the problem here is when we were growing up, youth sports was not expensive. It really wasn't. I mean, travel teams didn't form until, you know, late middle school, typically, if at all. We often just kind of tried out for our high school teams. There was, you know, no fee to it. It was just open to everyone. But the landscape has been completely transformed, largely by the chase for the athletic scholarship. I mean, this is what's driving the early forming travel teams, you know, the private trainers, the out-of-state tournaments, the $300 bats, on and on and on. And when you set those kinds of economic barriers, you're inevitably going to leave a lot of kids out, especially when schools and park and recreations, meaning cities, have decided to disinvest in public recreation. So it's become something of an arms race at the top end, and increasingly there are more kids who just simply can't afford those organized teams, or any, or at least a sustained experience, you know, through middle school and into high school.
So it sounds like you're saying, in part, we've privatized youth sports in a lot of ways to private club experiences, and retreated from the public sphere, the schools and the community programs?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it has been privatized. I mean, you know, it's not the case everywhere, and certainly there are schools that still invest in a big way. You know, I mean, shoot, look at like the prep schools, the private schools. I mean, you know, universal access to playing sports there. You know, if they're, you know, 60 kids who come out for soccer, they'll create two soccer teams, or 90 kids, you know, they'll play three soccer teams or four soccer teams. However, they'll meet the demand of kids. But in a lot of school environments, you'll have, you know, 80 kids try out for the, in large urban schools in particular, you'll have 80 kids try out for the basketball team, and 15 will make it, and 8 or 10 will get playing time, and it's just not meeting the demand of kids. So the system is structurally pushing aside kids who aren't the best athletes or have access to all this early training that can, you know, position them for playing time in high school.
And yeah, that's another point you've raised in the past, that maybe there's too much focus on the kids at the top, the kids who are best at that sport, and then what does everybody else do?
Yeah, exactly. And the problem is once you decide that, oh, that kid is a promising 8-year-old athlete, now let's really invest in him. Parents invest in him. Coach puts him in all the, you know, best positions, asks him to play baseball, to pitch a bunch of games all the time because you want your best pitcher on the mound. The hazard, of course, is that you're going to burn kids out. And it does happen, and it happens all the time. You know, arms get worn out, knees get blown, unnecessary concussions happen. Eliminating kids, you know, from the opportunity to even playing in high school. If you have two or three concussions by high school, you really should not be playing at all at the high school level. So, you know, this earlier mode doesn't even necessarily serve the very kids at the top. Some get through, enough get through, but it's a little bit like throwing eggs against the wall and seeing which ones don't break. I mean, that's our sports system today.
Talking to Tom Ferry, Executive Director of the Aspen Institute Sports and Society Program, about youth sports. He thinks they're good, potentially very good for kids, but we don't always do things right. We don't make the most of them. He's looking to try to fix that. And that what you just said, Tom, reminds me of the idea of over-specialization, where parents maybe, or schools or coaches, push kids to play one sport, only that sport, to the exclusion of all others. And I keep seeing more and more about how bad that is, health-wise and burnout-wise, too. Why do you think we got into that specialized mode?
Because it's, you know, youth sports has been privatized. I mean, it's been privatized along the lines of single sports. So some guy knows soccer, so he starts a soccer program, and maybe he buys a facility. And next thing you know, he's sending a message to the kids in the program that, you know, if you're really going to be positioned for a college scholarship, or, you know, even playing time on your high school team later on, or whatever reward you want to put down the line, that you really need to play this game, you know, pretty much year-round, and to the exclusion, often, of other sports. They send that message. Now, there's no research that suggests that's actually the best pathway. In fact, anecdotally and research-wise, just the opposite is suggested. I mean, you look at a sport like tennis, for instance, which is known as a specialization sport and a lot of pressure on kids at a very early age. But, I mean, you know, the best athletes, certainly on the men's side, were multi-sport athletes at an early age. Roger Federer played a lot of soccer up to age 12. That's where his footwork came from. Same thing with Rafael Nadal. A lot of soccer up through age 12 or 13. So, I mean, on and on, Novak Djokovic, et cetera. I mean, in the NFL, the vast majority of players were multi-sport athletes into high school. So it doesn't make any sense research-wise, but the economy, the youth sports economy, which is driven by local mom and pops, these local programs, is sending this message because these people, these entrepreneurs, they need to pay their bills 12 months a year. So it's in their best interest to tell the family and the kid that you should play year-round at an early age. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but it's the economy. And parents, it just requires that parents, you know what good looks like in athletic development and push back or sign their kids up for programs that that recognize the value of multiple sport opportunities at an early age.
And then I want to talk about just part of making it fun for kids. And I think I've, as a soccer dad myself, I've seen some wonderful experiences and had some coaches that were great. And I've seen some teams where there was a very negative attitude on the parent sideline, sometimes from the organization itself. How does that kind of attitude hurt kids' sports?
Well, I mean, the problem is, I mean, they're supposed to be kids' sports. So if for kids. Unfortunately, youth sport today is designed by adults for adults to a large degree. We often do so thinking that we're trying to serve the interests of kids, but when we're honest with ourselves, that might be part of the equation, but a lot of it is just our own ego, competitive parenting, on down the line. We end up inserting our priorities and our needs into the situation, and that's unfortunate because it doesn't. I mean, sport is kids need to have ownership of the experience. They need to feel like this is theirs and develop intrinsic rewards and be able to try things and fail and not have adults yell at them or talk them in the car on the way home or at dinner table that night about what they did wrong. It's very hard as a parent. Look, I'm a parent as well. I feel all the same kind of emotions. I want my kid to succeed. I want them to be better than me. So it's hard. It's really hard on parents, but they do need to know that if they really want their kid to have a great experience, then they just simply need to create the environment to, and I'm sorry for the ambulance here in the airport. They need to create an environment where the kids can simply fall in love with the game, and they have access to good coaches, quality coaching coaches who know what kids want and how to effectively motivate them.
Tom Ferry is with us. He's executive director of the Aspen Institute Sports and Society Program, longtime sports journalist. We're talking about youth sports and how to make sure they're a positive experience and accessible to as many kids as possible. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Did you play a sport as a kid? What did you get out of it? Do your kids play a sport now? What do you like? What do you don't like about how youth sports are set up? Is it a positive experience? Do you see enough kids getting involved? And do you see some of the problems our guest is talking about? Over-specialization, adults taking all the fun out of it for the kids. Too much money. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Tom Ferry, Executive Director of the Aspen Institute Sports and Society Program. He's been writing about youth sports for a long time. We're talking about ways to make youth sports accessible to more kids and to make sure that it's a positive experience. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or have you been a youth sports athlete, parent, coach, league organizer? What works for you? What doesn't? What makes it positive for the kids? Where could we be doing better? Are we too focused on success in one particular sport? Have we taken the fun out of the game? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Sorry, let's make that the Ideas Network Facebook page. Check it out. We'll go to our callers now. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, I grew up in the 60s, and before parents were so concerned about childhood safety from strangers. And with the most fun in the summer was disorganized sports, sports that were not run by adults and organized into leagues, but simply, you know, pickup games in the sandlot or in the, or street hockey in the streets. Children need more of that. There was a good program on Brian Gumbel's Real Sports about organized traveling teams for children run by adults. It's a billion-dollar industry. Children need disorganized sports for children as play, not as competition. I'd be interested in your guest response.
Jim, thanks. Yeah, more disorganized sports, Tom.
Yeah, no, he's absolutely right. I mean, look, you know, at the Aspen Institute, we've got this, you know, this framework, 8 strategies for the 8 sectors that touch the lives of children called Project Play. You can, rather than reading through them all, it's just, you know, projectplay.us, you can check them out. But anyway, one of the first ones is encouraging free play. I mean, it's how kids fall in love, and it's inherently inclusive as well. I mean, if you let kids just make up games themselves, you know what they do? They don't put all the best kids on one team. They kind of make them even. They make the teams even. And they'll even do, like, do-overs. And they'll put, you know, 6 kids in the outfield, if it makes sense. I mean, they're amazingly creative. They solve all these problems if you just turn it over to the kids. So I completely agree with your last call. The challenge is hard to talk parents out of supervising their kids these days. They've been scared so much by the local TV media and otherwise about child predators and crime and so forth. And some of that, yeah, is real, but it's certainly no more prevalent than it was when we were younger, and it's still fairly rare. And, you know, but parents, they want to watch their kids. They feel like they need to. You know, it's the year of the 24/7 parent, where if you're not watching, you know who is. It's the first time in the history of humankind that we've had this kind of, this level of parenting. So how do you work with it? I mean, so on some level, it's a matter of, like, fine, you know, we'll take them to that organized practice, but then, you know, for part of the practice, the coaches will just kind of step back and let the kids sort of make up their own games, and it's more of like a loosely supervised environment rather than constantly micromanaging everything. It's these type of interventions that are going to be required moving forward.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to John in Walworth. John, hi.
Hi. Boy, where to go with this? I've got 2 grandkids that are involved in youth sports. They're both in 5th grade. And in 5th grade, it's like I can go from 2 sides, the football or the basketball. I attended a meeting where I was kind of pointing out that, you know, we're losing interest in some of the kids because – the ultra competitiveness. I mean, this was back in 4th grade. And I get the distinct sense, because the person who was running the whole program was the coach of the high school team, that there's a lot of worry about funneling and developing kids so that by the time they hit the high school, they are ready to contribute and make our team glorious. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. So, John, thanks for the call. Tom, John is seeing people treating as early as 4th or 5th grades as talent development leagues, and I assume a lot of focus on winning there, too. What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's nothing wrong with, you know, helping teach kids skills at an early age, getting them environments where they're exposed to competition. That's fine. The trouble with these sports is it gets very exclusionary very quickly. So if you're one of the better kids, you may make the travel team, and, you know, we're creating these teams earlier and earlier. And the other kids who don't make it or don't feel like they should even try out because they don't have a chance, they get, you know, sort of placed in the in-town rec league, which, you know, the coaches don't ask them for much. They're not teaching many skills. It's a lower level of competition. It has fewer bodies. And then very quickly, like in my town, the rec leagues are pretty much gone by, you know, certainly by 5th, 6th grade in most sports. So, you know, that's the problem. It's not that training is bad or competition is bad. It's exclusion is bad. It's you know, telling kids, sorting the weak from the strong well before they grow into their bodies and their minds and their interests. It's just not fair to kids, and it's not wise. You know, pro sports is full of late bloomers. people who didn't really come into their own until high school or even college in some cases. So, we need a heck of a lot more patience and a heck of a lot more consideration of the kids who maybe aren't those early blooming athletes.
John, thanks for that call. We're talking to Tom Ferry, longtime sports journalist, now with the Aspen Institute Sports and Society Program, looking at youth sports. Randy is next with us in Appleton. Randy, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, we have a problem with a lot of high school coaches inferring to young families and young kids that unless they play club teams, that they cannot play in high school. I ran a youth sports program in our community, and we've run into that real quite a bit in the last couple of years, where it's right even at the high school level, where the high school coach tries to impress on them, you play club teams because youth programs, the community youth programs, aren't coached properly. It's all competitive, very competitive, and our youth program is very inexpensive, $35 a family. Many kids as you have versus $300-$400 for a club team.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. So high school coaches pushing the private sector in effect, Tom.
Yeah, a lot of it's sort of silly. I mean, the high schools want the kids to only focus on the school teams, and the clubs in some cases, some sports, volleyball, soccer now, are asking kids not to play any school sports because, they want them in their own training environment moving forward. And none of it really is – nobody's actually thinking about what is really best for the kids. You know, it's the high school coaches who are thinking about what's best for them and, how are they going to create a winning team. And then the, clubs, which are taking their cues from the national governing bodies, are more interested in developing national teams. Having one out of the 500 kids present themselves as a potential contributor on the national team. And it's just, it's a bit chaotic, and I'm dealing with it right now. I mean, my son plays club and he plays middle school, and he ends up, doesn't want to miss on either. And they're both, insisting on commitments. Last week he was playing, 4 to 5 hours of soccer every week during tryouts at school and then, club. So he wants to play with his friends at school, but he also wants to test himself a little bit in the club environment. And neither of those environments, those leaders are talking to each other and say, okay, how do we design something that's actually best for the kids? And that's where we need to get to.
Briefly, Tom, I've seen it stated maybe by you that a lot of countries have a Ministry of Sports to try to untangle some of these issues. Do we need something like that at the state level or even the federal level just in our last 30 seconds or so?
There's no one silver bullet here. It's going to take parents need to get activated, governing bodies need a whole range of different interventions. Is there a greater role for the federal government in coordinating sport activity or at least setting research agendas or otherwise? Yeah, probably there is. Now, what exactly that entity is, I don't know. I'm not sure how much appetite there is for a sports ministry in this country. But I do think there is, clearly, it's a bit of a chaotic environment right now, and so shaping the conversation at the federal level, in an open an open kind of way, I think would be it might not be a bad thing.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
That's Tom Ferry, Executive Director of the Aspen Institute Sports and Society Program, longtime sports journalist. We've been talking about youth sports. He says they're great, and we could do a lot better the way we run them. We've been talking about sports for kids. Now, how about sports for the grown-ups? A lot of people are probably wrapping up or just wrapped up their summer softball leagues out there. I just talked to a friend yesterday who won a Wisconsin Seniors ping pong tournament in West Allis, a big deal. I talked to some WPR colleagues about going outside and kicking a soccer ball around at some point. I don't think there's going to be any running involved. I don't think anybody would be up to par. Oh, we've got roller derby people around WPR. Dean, Nod, are you doing any kind of sports stuff? Dean at the board here. He's swinging a baseball bat. Good pantomime. Golf club. Yeah, you're a big golfer. Now, we want to know about you. Do you, in your adult life, play a sport? Maybe you picked up a new one. Maybe you went back to something you did as a kid. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us, @CentralTimeWPR, or send us a Facebook message on that Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us about your adult sports experience or lack of same. Why do you do it, or what's keeping you from doing it? Thinking about doing maybe a segment on this in the future, so we'd love to hear your input. Again, email ideas@WPR.org, tweet us @CentralTimeWPR, or Facebook message Ideas Network's, the Ideas Network's Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.